Are you ready to make the most of your oil and gas mineral rights? Welcome to the Mineral Rights Podcast. Get the knowledge and resources you need to manage your minerals and royalties. Here is your host, Matt Sands.
Hello and welcome to the Mineral Rights Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Sands, and I'm here to help you make the most of your mineral rights and royalties. And my co-host, Justin Williams, is here as well. Morning, Justin.
Good morning, Matt.
So we got some interesting stories lined up here, and what we're going to talk about today is mineral rights news for June 2021. Before we hit record, Justin and I were talking about just the interesting developments in the industry recently, some of the companies selling assets to reduce their carbon footprint, and definitely a couple of articles talking about opportunities in renewables and so forth. And so it seems like that's the theme. Whenever you open up the newspaper or you search for articles on oil and gas or mineral rights, that's what comes up. And it is relevant, I think, because these are the types of issues we're faced with as mineral and royalty owners, and new opportunities and new challenges. So that's what we're going to talk about today. So Justin, what stood out to you in these articles as far as some of the surprises that you saw?
I think it's really interesting how we're starting to see the oil companies positioning themselves, and they're being very careful in the way that they're approaching what they're calling their fuels, and then also the plan on how they're going to diversify over the next 10 years. I mean, it seems like over the last couple of years, this is maybe not a radical shift, but it seems like we're seeing more and more talk from those operators about alternative projects that they're getting into and light at the end of the tunnel for what direction that they're going to go with renewables.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think, one of the other things we were talking about was the ESG, which is the, environmental, you have the social and the governance side of things. And it seems like for whatever reason, and I'm not against ESG. I think if it's done right in a principled manner, it can be good. If it's done in a objective way, it gives you a clear picture of the trade-offs associated with investing in a particular company. But a lot of times, for whatever reason, the E part seems to have a lot more weighting than the S and the G, especially. So, we see this big focus on the environmental side of things. These articles touch on that, but then we're not really having the deep conversation around the social impacts of some of these changes, whether it's the shift to renewables and the potential for blackouts and those types of things. And what is that going to mean to society and the way that we have to conduct our day-to-day lives? Are we going to be expected to make changes to, shut off power during peak times to prevent just mass blackouts? Or, is it that we're okay with some cases, things like lithium or cobalt being mined by child labor or potentially by slave labor? And, that to me needs to be up front, in terms of these conversations, because it seems like we're willing to make the trade-offs around environmental side of things in exchange for kind of turning a blind eye to some of the other issues. I don't know. What do you think, Justin?
I'm right there with you. And, I think it'll really be interesting to see if we start hearing more about not just solar and wind and those kind of renewable sources, but clean fuels. Are we going to start to hear more about making a shift to natural gas rather than the heavier fuels that we've been using? Or is that just going to be something that kind of goes unsaid and unseen, but is changing, or is it not going to change?
Yeah, those are good points. And so with that, we'll dive into the first story. And this is an interesting one because I actually worked on this facility when I was working at Shell. So Shell to sell interest in Deer Park Refinery to partner Pemex. Royal Dutch Shell agreed on Monday to sell its controlling interest in a Texas refinery to partner Petróleos Mexicanos, Pemex, for about $596 million, the latest move by the European oil major to cut its global refining footprint. And before we dive into this story, I saw an interesting article today that a Dutch court ruled, against Shell. There was an environmental group that sued Shell and saying that they needed to cut their carbon emissions. And so this group was basically, the Dutch courts enforced this request by these environmental groups that Shell has to cut its carbon emissions. So not a huge surprise that this story then breaks as well. I'm sure these were going in parallel. And it's not, I don't think, a knee-jerk reaction to that lawsuit in Holland, which I think will get appealed. And so it's sort of, a ridiculous lawsuit. But, you know, at the end of the day, they're getting a lot of scrutiny, as Justin mentioned, you know, the focus on switching to more, you know, clean fuels and things like that. And so they're getting a lot of scrutiny from shareholders and the board to make sure they're doing things that are, whether they're just truly moving in the right direction or seen as moving in the right direction, could be argued. But I think this fits into the category of moving along that journey towards the lower carbon future. The article goes on to say that Shell is shrinking its refining and chemicals portfolio as part of a broader shift by oil majors to reduce hydrocarbon emissions and shift to lower carbon fuels. The deal is supposed to close at the end of the year. And this is something that the Mexican president was in favor of because they were complaining that they hadn't gotten the returns that they were expecting from this partnership. And so I think they're seeing this as a win in their case. And the thing that the article does say is the refinery can process up to 340,000 barrels of oil into gasoline and diesel. And then they were actually revamping the joint venture a couple of years ago in a move to have the facilities purchases of Mexican crude beginning in 2023. So to a certain extent, I think this was Mexico's opportunity to ensure they had a market to take their crude. Because one thing that's important to know is the blend of crude that they were refining at Deer Park, or that they are refining at Deer Park, is the Mayan crude blend, which is a heavy oil blend. And so, you know, you can't just switch it over immediately to these light sweet crudes like West Texas Intermediate or a lot of the stuff that's being produced now in the U.S., in West Texas especially, because they aren't, the refinery is just not set up to run those types of crude blends. And so I think they were making some changes to the facility to allow them more flexibility in running different crude blends. But I think at the end of the day, Mexico Pemex saw this as a way they could secure a market for their crude, which is good for them. And then, you know, like we talked about, Shell is looking at it and saying, you know, in our total portfolio, what are the emissions and the carbon footprint associated with different facilities? And like Justin and I were talking about, I've got to think that refineries up on the higher end from a carbon footprint standpoint. And so they were looking at a way to reduce their carbon footprint, monetize this, reduce the amount of exposure they had to refining, which in many cases is not that profitable anyway. Just depends on the margins and all of that, but it can definitely be, you know, in the grand scheme of things, it's not like they're printing money all the time. So probably a good business decision from Shell's standpoint, take advantage of that unique buyer that they had in Pemex that really needed this facility, gives them an opportunity to shift again and to use that money to invest into lower carbon fuels, as they say, which I would assume that they're talking about things like hydrogen and maybe natural gas as well. But it'd be interesting to see what kind of investments they make going forward and how that shift actually occurs. So,
yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I'm sure Shell was feeling that pressure, as you mentioned. So I'm sure that if nothing else, alleviates some of the pressure that helps keeping things moving forward. So we had talked about previously on a news episode, New Mexico and the impact on the federal leasing ban would have on New Mexico, because a lot of New Mexico's mineral rights are tied to or close to federal leases. And we have a story here that kind of addresses that, or at least is giving some direction on what they're thinking. So the title here is New Mexico's oil and gas regions could become leaders in hydrogen power, Congress people say. So as the federal government sought to shift towards less carbon-intense forms of energy, New Mexico's Democrat congresspeople appealed to the U.S. Department of Energy to focus efforts to develop hydrogen power in their state. So U.S. Senator Martin Heinrich and Ben Ray Lujan and U.S. Representative Teresa Leer Fernandez wrote a letter to the U.S. Energy Secretary Jennifer Granholm, calling on the Department of Energy and administration of President Joe Biden to make New Mexico the world's premier center of excellence for hydrogen energy production, research, and workforce. And so New Mexico has a combination of outstanding attributes that make it uniquely suited to serve as the powerhouse of the nation's emerging clean hydrogen economy, which is already attracting significant attention and investments from the industry, read the letter from the congressman. So it's really interesting, Matt. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see what they can kind of move forward with on this. Hydrogen is something you really don't hear about. And the article goes on to say that in March, the Department of Energy announced $2 million in federal grants to help develop hydrogen power technologies to develop four projects in Alabama, California, Kentucky, and Utah.
You know, this was an interesting one because this article mentions these projects talking about co-gasification blend that use waste from materials like biomass, plastic, and coal feedstocks that are then used to create hydrogen when they combine it with oxygen and steam at high pressures. And I don't know about you, Justin, but that just sounds like a pretty toxic mix. So if you are burning these things at really high temperatures, yeah, you're creating hydrogen, but really, you know, how is that better than burning natural gas? You know, the byproduct of combusting natural gas is CO2 and water. So yeah, there's CO2 that's generated, but again, if we're looking at ways to capture that and utilize it for things like enhanced oil recovery, then it's not getting emitted into the atmosphere. And the thing is, yeah, maybe you have a little bit lower CO2 footprint from this process, but I've got to think the toxic metals and chemicals and other things that you're emitting are got to be a lot worse than a little bit of CO2 and water. So, you know, I don't know. I'm kind of skeptical on this particular technology. There's got to be other ways to produce hydrogen that's a lot more efficient. You know, they talk about producing hydrogen using natural gas. That is not as clean in the mind of the author of this article, at least, which was surprising to me. I don't know a ton about the hydrogen technologies, but just it's interesting, like we talked about before, the environmental side of things getting a big focus as it relates to CO2 emissions. But then, you know, what are the other trade-offs, you know, to the people that live around these plants and the other stuff that's going on there? And that is both from a social and environmental standpoint.
You nailed it. And something that just always goes through my mind with stories like this is, you know, how long is it going to take to go from zero to having this be something that can replace what was lost in the oil and gas industry, if that was the intent of it? Mm-hmm. And, you know, you've got to think it's a long runway to get there.
Yeah, it's got to be a long runway. And, you know, I do think other technologies that we've talked about on the show before, there's what they call green hydrogen, where they actually use things like solar and wind to generate electricity, and then through electrolysis, break down water into, you know, hydrogen gas that then can be stored underground and then used when the wind and solar isn't generating electricity. They can use that to run gas turbines and kind of more traditional generators to generate electricity like we do with natural gas-fired power plants. So to me, that is more of an interesting and more attractive use case for hydrogen. These other, you know, and $2 million that they're talking about is pretty small in terms of the grand scheme of things. And so especially when you talk about how much money the federal government is printing right now, you know, trillions of dollars that are being generated, $2 million is just a drop in the bucket. But I think it's important to have these conversations to figure out what really makes sense, you know, if we're going to be shifting away from higher footprint, whether it's coal or whether it's oil and things like that, and looking at, you know, cleaner natural gas and hydrogen, there's got to be really a very close look at the trade-offs and do it in a way that's sustainable and that actually makes sense and it's profitable, because the government can't prop these industries up forever, you know, with subsidies and stuff like that. So.
Exactly. And you've got the next story, Matt, about people moving around the money.
Yeah. Speaking about juggling capital and into green projects, so to speak, article says global oil, natural gas companies juggling capital to green up portfolios. So this is very much in line with what we just talked about in the last two stories. The article says the transition to a net zero carbon future puts uncertainty into an estimated $14 trillion worth of upstream oil and natural gas assets, with no assurance that demand will continue to rise, according to analysts. While global demand is forecast to increase for another decade or more, there's growing pressure to limit global warming to 2 degrees Celsius by 2050. The International Energy Agency, the Global Energy Watchdog, said Tuesday, no more oil and gas field developments should be sanctioned if the world is to have a shot at achieving net zero emissions by 2050. I don't know. Did you see that story, Justin, as well as kind of a side note? That was amazing.
I did. And I was, maybe I don't watch the IEA as closely as I should, but it was kind of a gut punch. I was really surprised to see that coming from them in such a bold statement.
I agree. I was really surprised. I think it's a ridiculous statement because you can't just, you know, shut off the spigot and then expect us to switch over to bioenergy, hydrogen, wind, whatever you want to do. You know, there's got to be a gradual transition. So the decline rates of these current wells, especially shale wells and things like that, are steep. And so in order to meet current demand, we need to be drilling. It's not that we're growing production just to keep production stable. To meet demand, we need to continue to drill wells. And so it just shows a lack of, to my mind, a fundamental understanding of the real drivers within the industry. It's just a very political statement. And, you know, I guess just goes to show how political the IEA has become, not a neutral, you know, organization kind of, and again, very much focused on a certain narrative that is related to this net zero by 2050, which, you know, we got to do things to manage carbon emissions. We got to do things very much with a mind on what's the impact on the environment going to be? What's the social impact going to be? But just to blatantly say that no more oil and gas development should be pursued, I think is a ridiculous statement. But we'll link to that article as well that talks about the IEA, their statement and their kind of the breakdown of that as well. But, you know, it was a very interesting news week when that came out.
Isn't that the truth? And something I found really interesting in the article is something here that oil still delivers significant value for many. Deloitte noted 2/3 of oil heavy portfolios deliver above average performance. Of the portfolios that have captured more renewable prospects, 9% deliver top quartile financial performance, underscoring the importance of a strategic, purpose-driven approach to portfolio transformation. And so I think that is very interesting to hear, and something that I certainly have been thinking about is how do you compare those two apples to apples if you're moving your portfolio, and do we truly even know the return on investment quite yet for those?
Yeah, that's a great point. I think, you know, you wonder how much some of these investments are betting on some sort of a carbon tax or some sort of an incentive scheme that will compensate them for that. So I think there's got to be some of that thinking going on. At the end of the day, though, you know, if you're investing in a company, a publicly traded company, especially, you're expecting a return on that investment. You're, you know, if it's paying dividend, you expect that dividend to continue. And so if they were to completely stop producing oil and gas, those dividends wouldn't be able to exist without, you know, really heavy government subsidies, which then is a whole nother conversation. But, you know, I think that is a very interesting point that was made in this article. I think that you got to balance that at the end of the day, because these companies are in business to make money and to provide a return to their shareholders, both from a environmentally sustainable point of view, but then also from a financially sustainable point of view. And so this is going to be a tough one. You know, it'll be interesting to see how they're able to balance that.
Absolutely. And to wrap it up here is our last story. So next steps in the Texas surface versus mineral rights. The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. So perhaps Bob Dylan would not have predicted this, but Texas generated nearly 22% of its electrical power from wind and solar energy in 2020, per the EIA. It also makes use of other natural resources, such as oil and gas and agriculture. The state allows minerals to be sold and owned separately from the surface in the context of wind or solar companies contracting for using the surface. Mineral and royalty owners of Texas often have their rights overlooked. In short, surface owners may find themselves unexpectedly restricted in their traditional activities. And so something that we're going to talk about in this episode, we've covered in episode 93, the pros and cons of the wind energy and leasing for a wind farm. And then also in episode 94, leasing land for a solar farm. In episode 95, we talked about this news story about a mineral owner who sued a solar company due to the limits on potential mineral development because of a solar farm on the surface. And Matt, this is, you know, something that's linked to the dominant estate concept that you covered in that episode. And the estate being split is what causes this conflict. So mineral estate versus surface estate issues can be mitigated by doing a thorough title search and getting buy-in from mineral owners up front. And, you know, this is something that seems like it's only going to come up more and more as we get into these renewables. The accommodation reach typically designates specific locations for drilling, locations of easements for roads and pipelines and placing equipment, all to prevent disruption to surface operations. Fortunately, today's technology has evolved so that wells can be vertical, intentionally deviated from the vertical or drilled horizontally, all of which may accommodate the needs of all parties. This is a negotiation process and there is no standard template. So Texas has not developed a body of law involving air rights, so we don't know if the surface owner has the right to the winds across the property. Can a next-door neighbor build a silo, barn, or other structure, or put in trees that may interfere with the wind or create shadows with no impediments? Do we need an air rights accommodation doctrine? Can the legislature provide an answer? And so, Matt, this is a really big question and really makes me wonder in some of the solar or the wind farms in like Sweetwater, I wonder how they're handling this, or did this just not come up? Were they selective with where they picked because of that?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, it could be that they selected a location where they could purchase surface rights that had the minerals, and so they didn't have to worry about that particular issue. That is definitely one way that a solar or wind developer can get around that issue, is just buy the minerals below that land. And so they sort of mitigate that issue around having to do a lot of negotiations with the mineral owners to make sure that their rights are upheld. So that is one potential solution. The other one, like the article sort of alludes to, is by getting the buy-in from the mineral owners up front. And I think that for a wind and solar project to be successful, that needs to be done so that they set aside surface locations to, you know, allow future oil and gas development. Like the article mentions, you know, wells can be drilled horizontally. You have lateral lengths that are, you know, 1, 2 to 3 miles long. So there's really no reason why a small few acres for that final footprint of that well pad, and, you know, plus some working space for when they're drilling the wells, you know, couldn't be set aside and used and allowed for oil and gas development in partnership with wind or solar if they're going to do that. So I think this is a good type of discussion around that accommodation doctrine. And again, that accommodation doctrine says that you have to accommodate the opposite estate. So whether you're the mineral estate accommodating the surface or the surface accommodating the mineral, you know, there needs to be a balance there, so that the rights of the other party aren't unduly restricted. And so it just a lot of good questions that are asked. And I think these are, we'll get answers to these over the next several years as case law develops in these areas. You know, the interesting thing is if you have a shadow that blocks the sun, you know, from your solar panels, or you have something that's blocking the wind, is that, you know, how is that going to be handled? You know, is there something that needs to be done there? I got to think that seems a little bit of a stretch, just because the wind, you don't know. I mean, you have a general wind direction maybe, or, you know, you know where the sun's going to come up and where it's going to set. But to me, that seems like that could be mitigated. You know, the buildings and structures aren't going to be that tall or block the wind that much, you know, in your adjacent property to make that big of a difference in the long run, especially if you have a big tract of land that you're looking at developing for solar or wind. So, but, you know, it's possible that those get tested and then we have some either legislation put in place or some case law to dictate how to treat it. So going to be interesting to see how it develops. I do think this is an area of the law that is going to continue to develop, and there's going to be more and more conflicts that arise just because, you know, we're seeing this big push towards more and more solar and wind. And so as that happens, we're going to see this being tested, I think.
Isn't that the truth? And if the oil and gas law is any kind of history, we're bound to see lots of little caveats be created from different court cases, that some of which we may not even be able to expect right now.
That's a great point. It'll be fun to watch. So on that note, that wraps up this month's Mineral Rights News episode. As always, if you could leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening to this, that would be the best way to help us out. And as always, you can send us feedback at feedback@mineralrightspodcast.com, and you'll find links to these articles at mineralrightspodcast.com. Thanks again for listening. Thanks, Justin.
Thanks, Matt.
Thanks so much for listening to the Mineral Rights Podcast with your host, Matt Sands. Don't forget to subscribe and share at mineralrightspodcast.com. The Mineral Rights Podcast should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy.